You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line today is Miss Jeanette Finicum, whose late husband, Robert Lavoie Finicum, was tragically killed by officers with the Oregon State Police on January 26th of this year in a joint FBI-Oregon State Police operation. Jeanette, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and you know, first off, I of course want to say, you know, I send my condolences to you and your family. You know, I really can't even imagine what it must be like to lose your husband in such a tragic manner. So I'm very sorry for your loss, and I just wanted to express that before we get started.
Thank you.
Now, could you talk about Lavoie and you know, maybe describe what kind of man he was, what kind of father he was, you know, just to kind of get this conversation started?
Sure. Lavoie was a wonderful man. He was kind and generous with his time and resources. He was a loving husband and father. His children meant the world to him, and they knew it because all of his spare time he spent with the family and with the kids. Lavoie was the type of man that if anybody needed anything, he was there. He would stop what he was doing and help them in any way he could. He was that way with our children as well as they grew up and moved out of the home. Whatever they needed and when they needed it, we just dropped everything and tended to them. Whether it was 3 o'clock in the morning, that didn't matter. My husband was one who believed in the Constitution and believed in America. He believed in government in its limited form. He believed that we were losing our freedoms. And he was one who was educating himself further to the issues that were facing us today. And so when he learned about the Hammonds, he felt bad for their situation. He never liked bullies. I've said this before. And he saw the federal government and the BLM as acting like bullies in their area, taking away everything that they had worked for their whole lives. And when they had then been arrested and incarcerated for the second time, or was about to be serving their second sentence for the same crime, he felt a need to go up and stand with them by placing the flowers and doing that rally that they had organized there in Oregon for that family.
I see.
That's just the kind of person he was.
Right. Now, and I understand you have one of your daughters with you as well today?
I do.
Yeah. Could you maybe describe what kind of father your dad was?
Yes. My name's Tara Tenney. And I like to describe Dad as a God-fearing man. He was one that the relationship with his God was paramount, and he often counseled me saying, it only matters if God is smiling. And I really admire him for his loyalty and love of his God. And he was a principled man. Which is why he found himself educating himself. And the more he became educated, he realized how the heavy hand of the federal government was intimately in the lives of the American people. And because he was a principled man, he couldn't in good conscience just do nothing. And so he needed to stand in his respective sphere to stand for the principles of liberty. And so that's how his story began. It began years ago as he practiced daily diligence in the things that edified and refined him as an individual. And it enabled him to be the powerful voice that America now knows him to be.
I see. Now, shortly before this this situation in Oregon, before he got involved in the Oregon standoff, he published a book entitled Only by Blood and Suffering, Regaining Lost Freedom, which is a novel, and it's available from Amazon.com. We will have a link over to the book when we post this program. Could you talk about this? This was the first book he published, from what I understand, the first and only book he published. How did this come about? How did he, what made him decide to write this novel?
Well, it happened probably, let's see, it's been about 3 years ago. It was before the Bundy incident that he actually wrote the book. And he has written another book. It just hasn't been published. We might be doing that shortly. However, when he started educating himself about the freedoms, he really thought, oh my goodness, people are just so unaware of what's going on around them. How can I help teach the principles of freedom? How can I help in this process? And he had a story that just came into his mind. And he felt that he could put it in a story form, in a novel, and then just try to help teach about freedom, about individual, about morals and values, and the importance of family, and all these different things that this book embodies. And he was able to sit down, and we do therapeutic foster care for teenage boys. And so he said, Jeanette, if you can pick up the slack and help me with the boys, I'll write this book. And so it was a family effort. The kids pitched in and I pitched in, and he sat and wrote for about 5 months, and then he had a finished product. And it was on my birthday that he finished it in June of 2000. I believe it was 13. I was the first one that got to read it, and it was really fun. He was like an expecting father, because he handed me the book and he says, okay, here you go. And he propped me up in bed and gave me some pillows. And he says, okay, I'll leave you alone and I'll watch all the kids and then I'll check in with you. And about an hour later, he's tapping on the door and he peeks in and he says, well, what do you think? And I says, oh, LaVoy, it's so good. You know, and I says, but you got to leave me alone so I can read it. And so he walked out and went back to the business of taking care of the kids. And about another hour, he tapped on the door, peeking his head through again and wanting to know where I was at. It was just so fun to watch him. It was like he was just excited to hear what I thought about it. And so finally, he had to just leave the house so he could leave me alone so I could read it. And and he did. And when he came back, I was finished with the book. It was hours, hours later. But it was such a beautiful book. It was so inspired. He really, I think the Lord really helped him in expressing many different things on many different levels. It touches the hearts of people and helps to stir that desire for freedom and learning and family and all the good things that America stands for, really, in my mind. Mm-hmm.
Now, could you talk about his relationship with the Bundys? Had he known the Bundy family for quite some time prior to, you know, traveling to Oregon with them?
No. I would say that he learned about the Bundy's situation, had been following it through the news. And, you know, for the last, probably 2012, 2013, he was just listening, about their plight out there. And then in 2014, when he heard about the standoff, and it was impending, it's just right there at that moment, he was up in Salt Lake for a conference, and he said, I just feel impressed. I need to just not be at this conference. I think I should go down and talk to these people. And so he did. He just left the conference in Salt Lake and drove all night to get to the Bundy's area, Bunkerville, and spoke with them. And Mr. Bundy said, well, if you want to be here, bring your horse and be here in the morning and bright and early. And so my husband came home and gathered up his horse and his trailer, and he got prepared, and he left the very next morning for the ride on horse with the rest of those cowboys that were on horse standing in front of the armed FBI and BLM agents.
And this would have been in the spring of 2014. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Going on, they developed a friendship, and they're very good friends of ours now.
I see. Okay. And from what I understand, Ammon actually, he lived in Arizona as well. Is that right? Ammon Bundy?
I'm not sure all the different places Ammon may have lived, but I'm sure he has.
Okay. I see. Now, and you kind of alluded to this, but could you maybe elaborate on it a little bit more? Why did Lavoie feel so compelled to go to Oregon and to stand with and support the Hammond family?
Because once again, he didn't like to see someone picked on, and he felt that the federal government and the system up there, the BLM, and within that little area there had taken from all of these different people and their farms, their livelihood, their ranches. Some had been burned out, some had been flooded out, some had been just picked away over time, like the Hammonds. And he just felt like that's just not right. We've got to start standing somewhere. And I think my husband felt impelled to go there and just be another person standing and be a voice for these people who had just had years and years of persecution, had been beaten down. You know, they had lost all hope. These people in Oregon had lost all hope. When they had to come out in the middle of the night just to be in the protection of the darkness, to go to the refuge, to speak to Ammon and to Lavoie, that says a whole lot. They were searching for help, and these people were, Ammon and the people up there were brave enough to stand for them, and they were begging that they wouldn't leave. What will happen to us if you leave? They kept asking my husband. You know, you have to stay, because if you don't, you know, what will happen to us?
Right. Well, when I was there, I actually did go up to the refuge in early January, and I did some interviews, and including with Lavoie. I have it's probably a 5 or 6 minute long discussion, and then we sort of are walking up the hill to where the press conference was taking place that afternoon. So it kind of transitions right into the press conference, and you can find that video on YouTube. But one of the things that really stood out to me, and a point that everyone that I talked to there was really emphasizing, was the fact that the Hammond family, once they were essentially resentenced and it was determined that the federal prosecutor appealed the original decision and was basically forcing them to go back to complete a 5-year term. Once that was decided and once the Bundys and your husband got involved and was offering support to the Hammond family, the feds really put the pressure on the Hammonds and were sort of intimidating them almost. That's kind of that was something that a lot of the people I talked to had mentioned. And I'm just curious, can you confirm that? Was the Hammond family pressured once it was discovered that the Bundys and some other individuals were coming to their assistance and trying to, you know, stand up for them?
Actually, I can confirm that through what my husband told me that Ammon had told him. That it was when that period of time when Ammon was up there by himself trying to exhaust every other possible avenue through the courts, through due process, and he exhausted every avenue. And during that period of time, and after Ammon left, before the occupation actually began, that's when the pressure was put upon the Hammonds by the FBI and threats. If you do this, we will find the worst jail for you to be in. They were trying to silence everyone and beat them down again. Yes.
Yeah, that certainly seemed to be the case. And it was incredible the way in which pretty much all of the local and county officials, you know, they were not interested in talking to Ammon or to anybody else, really. They were going along with what the feds wanted at every step of the way, it seemed like.
Yes, you're right. And one thing that I found here, just from a meeting that I was in with my husband, with county officials and branding inspectors and different things trying to get us to cooperate, they were concerned about their money coming from the federal government. If we didn't get into compliance, then we could be threatening the county's opportunity of receiving the monies that they needed from the federal government. And I just feel that we as Americans and as counties and cities and towns and states, we rely too much on the federal government's purse. We are no longer independent of them. We are no longer independent. And so they have this heavy arm that hangs over us, that they can just pull those strings anytime that they want or pound us into the ground if we're not in compliance, because then we don't get the money to fund this or fund that or, you know, fund the schools. They try to get you right where your heart is at. And so I just say, let's back from that. Why do we need to have so much money from the federal government to run our own cities, towns, states? Why can't we become more independent?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a major issue at play here. And we see this taking place really all across the country where local and county and state governments are basically they've totally caved in and surrendered to the federal government. It's very clear that this is what's going on. And a lot of it does revolve around money and federal grants and other federal money to pay for programs and to pay for services that are handled by the states. So yeah, it's obviously a major issue impacting everyone in the United States. And, you know, I wanted to move on and ask you about, and this was something that really fascinated me and that I was really, sort of analyzing this entire time, including to this day, is the mainstream media's coverage of the Oregon standoff and of the nature of the occupation and who some of these people were. In some cases, we had, mainstream media essentially depicting these people as terrorists, as you know, your husband and Ammon Bundy as terrorists. Some of them were saying they were white supremacists, for goodness sakes. So there was a lot of very distorted and biased reporting going on, at least from what I could tell, and very little objective coverage of what was taking place. So what's your take on the way that the mass media reported on this event?
Well, we believe that it was by design that there was a false narrative being fed to the population. And I just want to be clear in the understanding that this never, ever was a standoff. That word is completely inappropriate. It was them petitioning the government for a redress of grievances, which is our First Amendment right. We have that right to do that when we are being suppressed and abused by a tyrannical government. And that is exactly what they were doing. Now, my definition of a standoff is two separate parties angrily and aggressively facing each other with weapons about ready to act upon that frustration. And that never was the case. They were exercising their Second Amendment right, which is a right that they have to do. Going back to the Bundy situation, you know, who was pointing guns at who back then? Who was tasing who back then? Who was pepper spraying who? Who was throwing pregnant women on the ground? You know, it was our tyrannical government. And these men who were being courageous enough to stand up to a government that's overreaching and too powerful has every right to exercise their Second Amendment right. And I think that a lot of people in America, they don't understand the significance of our rights. And I think this, our negligence and our naivete in our human rights is what has gotten us where we are today. And the media was able to find success in twisting the truth when they were exercising their God-given rights.
I was going to say really quick that that's a good point you bring up about the redress of grievance, which, from what I understand, was made public on Friday, December 11th of 2015, so last year, well before the occupation of the wildlife refuge. And this was a redress of grievance that was submitted on behalf of the Hammond family, and there's a number of organizations that were sort of involved in it, and they sent it to local and county and state officials in Oregon, including the sheriff, including some of the county commissioners, including the district attorney and the governor, and they were entirely ignored. And this was something that was never reported on in the mass media, at least to my knowledge. I don't remember anybody really talking about the redress of grievance that was submitted and ignored, which is what led to the entire situation unfolding the way it did.
I don't remember reading any of that either. I just remember them labeling them as domestic terrorists.
Right, exactly, yeah. So there was no effort to objectively find out what the grievance was, what the problem was up in Oregon. They were just, you know, portrayed as these anti-government extremists, essentially.
And because the mass public depends upon their information from these news outlets, they just take whatever is spoon-fed to them. They don't even look into it individually for themselves. And so these buzzwords, terrorist, white supremacist, gun-toting, crazies, whatever they labeled them as, they just, you know, the people just accepted what they were being told instead of looking into it for themselves. And you go to compare, you know, situations that have happened back east in Ferguson or Baltimore, the protests, the destruction of property, the looting, the theft, the hurting of other individuals during their protest. They don't even compare. There was such peace up there at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. It was unbelievably night and day. We were able to come and go freely. My husband took me to breakfast Sunday morning before I left the refuge, just before he was killed. Nobody even attempted to stop him, arrest him, confront him in any way, nor was he belligerent in any way. And I know of two separate times when I was there personally that Ammon went into town, to the airport where the FBI was, stood right there in front of the FBI and negotiated with the negotiator over the phone, who was not even in the same area, which couldn't even give him any answers to any of the questions or negotiate, really. He says, well, if you can't make these negotiation conferences successful, then tell me who can. Who can you send here that can actually negotiate? And so he left twice feeling discouraged and, because the FBI was just like stringing them along. They had no intention of trying to make it a peaceful outcome, none whatsoever. But yet they were able to come and go freely. They weren't arrested. There were so many opportunities for a peaceful outcome rather than what ended up happening.
And yeah. I have to say that my dad, Lavoie Finicum, and the other cowboys, they had indisputable moral high ground.
Yes.
The rule of law, the United States Constitution, stood behind them. Any person who's willing to see truth is able to recognize that. And it is our American authorities who have abandoned this rule of law. And it is our American authorities who lost their moral high ground when they opened fire on a man who had his hands in the air in surrender.
Right. Yeah. And I want to talk about the Oregon State Police FBI operation, which ultimately led to your husband and to your father's death. And what was interesting in the way that all went down is you're right. I mean, when I was there, you could come and go freely. I don't think I saw any law enforcement at all the entire time I was there. Everybody at the refuge was very pleasant and very nice. You know, I could talk to people, I could interview people. There was no threats or intimidation or anything like that. It was a very peaceful environment. But what was interesting was that in the week, basically the week leading up to to January 26th, the Oregon governor and a number of leading officials in the state at the county level, for example, the newspaper, the Oregonian, everyone was basically coming out saying the same thing. Look, the federal government has to step in and end this occupation, end this protest with force if necessary. And then that's exactly what we saw happen shortly after everyone was making these demands.
Yes, you have a governor here in Oregon that says, go ahead, shoot to kill, basically. Get this mopped up. I'm tired of this being in my state. And then you have another governor across the country in a different protest where they're rampaging all through the town, destroying property, saying, just give them space. Let them get it out of their system. You have two different ways of looking at these things. And I feel like she needs to be held personally responsible along with the other officials, the judge, the sheriff, et cetera. I think all of them need to be held personally responsible for what has happened.
The day he was murdered, they were in transit to the neighboring county where a constitutional sheriff, Glenn Palmer, had gathered a large number of his citizens to hear their presentation on natural rights. And we all know how that story ended. He was murdered in transit. And it was Senator Ron Wyden who had stated, we have got to stop this virus before it spreads. Now, that one-liner is very foretelling of the corruption of that leader. Yeah. And because this virus that he's speaking of is the spirit of liberty that they were igniting in the hearts of their citizens. And, you know, the cliche saying ignorance is bliss. Yeah, it is. If you're the leader who is manipulating and taking advantage of your citizens' natural rights for your own monetary or power gain. And not on top of that, Governor Kate Brown's statement illustrated her disregard for the rule of law when she had said, line, the federal authorities must move quickly to end this occupation and to hold all these wrongdoers accountable. She was clear to communicate that she was speaking out because the situation, in her words, was absolutely intolerable. Now, let's just talk about that for a minute, how foretelling that is. These people had my dad. We all, as American citizens and human beings, have a right to redress a tyrannical government for a redress of grievances. We have that right. And they were doing so in a very peaceful, respectful way. And she, as a leader, needs to tolerate that, and she needs to hear it, and she needs to address it. And just shortly after these two significant organ leaders made their foretelling statements is when he was murdered. Now, I believe that his assassination is a political one and that the tentacles run far and deep and wide. If you follow the money, you'll see the corruption. You know, I firmly believe that the Clinton Foundation is connected to this and that they were uncovering a lot of corruption there through the documents that they were going through. And somebody put in a buzzer and they had to end it quickly because people were going to incorrupt. People who were doing corrupt things were being made known.
Right.
And they just couldn't have that. So that's why he was murdered.
Right. And it's interesting also, I mean, he basically predicted this to happen, you know, a day or two before it actually did. He was being interviewed by Oregon Live, which is, you know, affiliated with the Oregonian. I believe it's just their online, website versus the newspaper. And he basically said that. He said that the tone had changed and, you know, that they seemed to be much more confrontational and, you know, sort of looking for an excuse to take us out, basically.
Yeah. Yep. And they did.
Right. Well, I want to get your reaction to, because the day this happened, the FBI almost immediately released the footage, the aerial footage that didn't have any audio, but it showed pretty much what happened. And they were really trying to, essentially demonstrate to the public that, look, we did everything we could to do this peacefully. It didn't work out that way. They were basically trying to cover for themselves, essentially. I think that's very clear. So what is your reaction to the initial footage that was released and how the FBI and the Oregon state officials kind of handled it?
That video did nothing but confirm to me how he was actually assassinated, murdered by them. Because I know my husband. I know what type of man he is. I know who he is. I know that he would care about the three people that were left in his vehicle. He would put their lives above his own. And I know that when he left that truck, immediately you can see his hands going up before he's even completely out of the truck. His hands are in the air and he is running away from the truck to divert the attention onto himself because he didn't want to see that 18-year-old girl in the backseat murdered. We have an 18-year-old daughter. And he would feel so responsible for all of their lives in the back there. And so I know he did that to draw attention to himself. I know that as he was being shot, that he continued to put his hands in the air to show he was still not holding a weapon. And I think that it has damned them in this whole investigation. And as more and more information continues to come out, the FBI lying and not coming forth with the truth and trying to hide things, an independent investigation of that is not going to make me feel any better about what they're doing, because I believe that they're continuing to hide and take evidence that is needed. I happen to know of other things that are disappearing in evidence. And so I have no confidence, none whatsoever, in our government and in that community at whatsoever in putting forth an honest and upright investigation. I think that they are worried and they want to cover their rear ends and make sure that they come out smelling like a rose. But the American people, we who have seen this video, we who read this information, see what they're doing, and we are going to hold them accountable because we are not going to be lied to anymore.
Right. And the Oregon State Police, their investigation was recently released, and they actually make it clear that there, it does appear to be shots fired by officers with the FBI, agents of the FBI. And it seems pretty clear that the FBI has been lying about this, and they have been, like you said, trying to cover their own tracks and, you know, downplay their mishandling of this case.
Yes, and I feel that that report was downplayed as well. I feel that there's more that we don't know because they're lying. They've lied. I believe they'll continue to lie to continue to cover it up, and they will just give the minimal truth until they're found out. That has been their MO. That's the way they will continue to operate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, what is your next course of action?
Well, I'm currently deciding what that course is, but I am going to move forward. I am going to hold them accountable.
Very good. Okay. And I'm sure that we will have updates as that proceeds.
Yeah.
Now, how can people support you or follow the latest developments? Is there a website, or maybe how can people get in touch with you and support you even?
Well, we do have a website. It's One Cowboy Stand for Freedom. And on there, there's a link to our blog that we will be publishing our progress and updates and action items on there. Our website also has Dad's product. So his novel that he wrote, t-shirts that he had designed, and things like this. And on the website, there's also a button for a petition for a congressional investigation. We're trying to collect 100,000 signatures if it gets to the point where we need to have a congressional investigation. And we do have a form that is titled, How Can I Help the Finicum Campaign? We need people who are helping spread the correct narrative and just becoming informed. And we're also inviting everybody to become educated, to read the Constitution, learn of the principles of liberty, and choose to live by those principles and to teach your posterity the same. Because even though we have Constitution and law established, and some even would say that our Constitution and law is the strongest and the best created, the spirit of liberty has to be reignited in every generation. And when we have that spirit of liberty absent, we are in risk of losing our freedom. And I think that's where our people are today. Mm-hmm. It's, we've enjoyed the blessings of liberty without really having to sacrifice for it, to suffer for it, to defend it, and to even die for it. And that's the legacy that my dad lived. He was willing and he did do all of those things. But much of today's generation does not understand this. And so the spirit of liberty is, it's kind of like a habit of the heart. It's lost. And freedom, therefore, is at risk of being lost. And so these things need to be taught in the homes of every American. Mm-hmm. So education.
Well, yeah, that's very well said, and you know, I completely agree with you. And just to wrap up, I have one final point, and that is when I was up there and talking to many of the individuals involved, one thing was very clear that what they were doing, it was much bigger than just the Hammond family. It was much bigger than just their plight, their situation. This was a broader movement. And I think what you just explained there, that really kind of underscores that sort of mindset, that this is a bigger, this is more than just, you know, what's going on in Oregon. This is something that's going on all across the country. And there's very fundamental principles that go to the heart of this country and the founding of this country.
Absolutely. You're spot on. And it's something here on the West that involves us, the ranchers. But we are losing freedoms in every aspect of our life here in America. And it goes clear across the United States. It's not just the plight of the ranchers.
Right. Well, thank you very much. Thank both of you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. I know this is a very difficult subject. And again, my condolences go out to you and your family. It's truly a tragic situation. And, you know, we're going to continue to shine the light on it and to do our best to provide some objective and accurate coverage of the situation. So thank you very much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure all of our listeners and readers do as well.
Thank you so much, John, for having us.
Thank you.